Dip, 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 dip. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Good evening. This is the Labor Exchange. I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. Please note, this is a replay from a previous Labor Exchange radio show. At that time, the show was called Women's History Month, Women, Labor, and Political Leaders, Part 2. With us was a very special guest at that time, Josette Jaramillo, President, Colorado AFL-CIO, President and President of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local Union 1335, Pueblo County, Pueblo, Colorado. And that aired on Monday, March 18th, 2019. Josette, thank you for being back here at KGNU on the Labor Exchange.
Yeah, no problem, Dennis. I mean, it's always a pleasure to chat with you and get an opportunity, you know, to, you know, chat, I guess, like theoretically with your members who are listening, right?
Yes, that's it. So let's begin with some background for those listening members. And so I have like three quick questions for you is, how long have you been a union member? What is your union affiliation? And what kind of work did you do at the outset of your union employment?
Well, I'm lucky enough that I call it my union birthday, is the same day as my actual birthday. So August 5th, 2005 is when I became a member. So I am headed on, 13 years?
14 years.
14 years as a card-carrying member of AFSCME, Local 1335. I actually am still employed with my 8-to-5, as I call it. I work for Pueblo County Department of Human Services and Child Welfare. I work in the foster care unit, so I license and certify foster parents for Pueblo County.
All right, then. Could you discuss, at this point, your experience in leadership positions with this union, AFSCME?
Yeah. So I've been the local president for the past 10 years. I started off as a canvasser, and then I was invited to be an executive board member, and then the next year after that, I ran for president, and I, you know, have been there ever since. I also took on a leadership position shortly after my election as president with our state council. I served as 2 terms as the vice president of AFSCME Colorado, which at the time was Council 76, and then I served again another 2 years as the president of AFSCME Colorado Council 76. We since went through like some mergers, so we have merged with Council 18, so I still have a leadership position on that executive board as the representative from Colorado on AFSCME Council 18, Colorado, New Mexico.
All right, then. Just said, let's move into new leadership. And this was a question, and I think it's important to ask it again from our last interview in October of 2017. When were you elected as president of the Colorado AFL-CIO? And with that said, with your election, you broke 3 historical barriers for this position. Could you share that with this KGNU listening audience?
Yeah, so I was elected as the president of the Colorado AFL-CIO in September of 2017. I am the first woman of color to hold this position. I'm the first person from outside of the Denver metro area to hold this position, and I'm the first LGBTQ member to hold this position.
All right, then. Thank you for sharing that. And what are and have been some of your immediate priorities as president of the Colorado AFL-CIO?
You know, I think I spent probably the first year trying to figure out, you know, what I'm doing and kind of who the players are and kind of learning new things, right? Because it was a big learning curve for me to figure out, you know, apprenticeship programs and how private sector unions work and how the structure of the AFL nationally and then locally and all that stuff. So I feel like it was a really big learning curve for me that first year. Some of my priorities have just been kind of reaching out to affiliates and making sure that our affiliates' voices are being heard and that we're really driving an agenda focused on affiliate concerns and affiliate priorities at the state level.
Josette, let's move into the content of the show with this part, women labor/union leaders.
So could you, your perspective, educate, inform this KGNU listening audience, especially our new and younger listening members, of the progress with what I would call quote-unquote elected, appointed women labor leaders on the national, state, and local levels within the labor movement here in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, in the past, you know, even 10 years, I think we've taken some big leaps forward in terms of having women lead, you know, large unions. I mean, in Colorado, you have myself, and then you've got, you know, Sarah Hamilton, who leads the American Federation of Teachers. You've got Kim Cordova, who leads United Food and Commercial Workers. At the national level, we have Liz Schuler, you know, Mary Kay Henry with SEIU, and Lisa Bolton, who's the vice president of CWA. You know, in our region, there are some really cool up-and-coming young women who hold leadership positions in their state federations, and one of them down in New Mexico is Ashley Long, who comes out of the American Federation for Teachers. She's the secretary-treasurer for the AFL-CIO down there. She's doing amazing things. And then in Texas, they have Montserrat Garabé, and she is doing amazing things with immigration and really tying the labor movement into a lot of that work that they're doing down there. So, I mean, I really think that things are shifting, that we're starting to see a different type of leader, I think, pop up throughout the whole country. You know, that's not anything that's specific to our region. It's something that's happening nationwide, and it's really cool. It's exciting to be a part of.
And how does this compare with the labor movement from 20 to 30 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think things are changing. Like I said, I think that folks are electing, and they want to see people elected who look like them, and they want to see people elected who represent their members. You know, my membership is 90% women at the Department of Human Services, and I think the same is true, you know, for, like, our teachers union. And, you know, our UFCW folks, you know, they've got a high Latino population. So having somebody lead the labor movement who looks like their members is a great way for them to have representation. So, I mean, it's certainly a big change from, you know, 20, 30 years ago when we had, you know, older white men in these positions.
Josette, then, how do popularly elected or appointed women labor leaders greatly assist the level of union density throughout the United States in the state of Colorado? And beyond that, how does this impact organizing with a majority woman workforce?
Well, I think that we can speak from experience, right, when we're talking about, and I think, you know, we'll get into this a little later, when we're talking about family leave, like, how does that affect you as a woman? How does discrimination, how does harassment, how do those things affect you as a woman? And really being able to speak from the heart about some of those issues, really being able to take part in the Women's March and saying, like, hey, this is for us. Being able to look at the Me Too movement and take a step up and say, you know, these things are not okay, and this is how we fix them. I mean, I think we're probably ahead of the eight ball as organized labor because we have strong union contracts, we have stewards. You know, those things that we can kind of pass on to other folks and say, hey, like, we're recognizing that this is a national problem, but we have a solution, and we always have. So hearing that from another woman, I think is powerful, because I think they're, you know, I mean, obviously we're unionists, right? There's power in solidarity.
And, you know, I've just, and you get the same reports I get from the AFL-CIO. I'm on their email list and everything else. And I think now that the total of union members in the United States is like 14.6 million. It fell about 0.1% over the past year, maybe 0.2, not much. But I think they said 7 million or more are now women. So I think that speaks to the, you know, the question, the first question I had, union density. It's growing, and I'm sure that it'll be at the majority sooner rather than later. So Josette, let's move into this, critical issues for women labor leaders. So let me begin with this one, gender equity pay gap. Could you discuss this issue and how it has had a negative historical impact on all women workers in the private and public sectors?
So, I mean, I think that that there's a lot of misconception about the pay gap, right, the gender pay gap, because I think you've got women who are in their workplaces making more money than men and saying that doesn't exist. But when you look at the salaries across even the state of Colorado, you know, there's a significant difference between how much men make on average and how much women make on average. Whether, I mean, and education isn't a factor in that. I mean, women are paid 80 cents on the dollar compared to men when you look at the average, you know, across Colorado. That, like, is lower for Latina women. So, like, I would make $27,000 less than my male counterpart. So I think when you look at the shift that's happened in our society where we don't, you know, women aren't staying home anymore, right? Like my grandma did. My grandma stood home with the kids and with myself when I was growing up. You know, women are workers, and it seems like there has been like a lag in catching up with the salaries, if that makes sense.
You know, Josette, how has public policy and or legislation address this issue?
Well, we try, right? I know that they have tried nationally every single year to pass the, you know, pay equity bill. I know that we've tried to pass it here locally and it's failed. I know the Lilly Ledbetter Act passed in Obama's first year of presidency, I believe. So, you know, we keep attempting to gain some ground on that stuff, and it seems like we continually are being pushed back in that. I think the political momentum is on our side right now to make sure that we get really great policies passed in Colorado, and I think the time is coming for that to happen nationwide as well. But, you know, we continue to support that legislation that's brought up at the Capitol every year, and hopefully one of these days we can kind of chip away at it and eat away at it, and then, you know, there won't be an 80 cent on the dollar pay gap, you know, 20 cent gap.
Josette, what are the advantages for all women like yourself working under a union collective bargaining agreement?
Well, so that's the only place where we don't see a wage gap is when the workplace is organized, because we have great collective bargaining agreements, right? We have stewards. We have those folks who are, you know, ear to the ground listening for those kind of things. I think a couple of years ago there was also some legislation passed that, you know, it was no, you couldn't be punished for sharing your salary. So those kind of things that we've advanced as labor and worked on as labor are the things that allow us to really kind of get in there and see what's going on. I mean, our, like in my workplace, I can speak for, like, there's no variance in pay because everything's done, you know, on a scale with a range. In the public sector, in the private sector, that's a little different. But when you've got a unionized workplace, you really do have people watching out for those kind of things, and that's the only time that pay gap shrinks significantly or is no longer in existence when your workplace is organized.
Josette, let's move into the next issue I have, workplace discrimination and harassment. Again, as we've talked about in the past, could you explain detail this issue and its impact on all women workers, and what might be some of the most egregious examples?
So I think that there are a ton of examples about workplace discrimination and harassment, and I think that we can even look back at the gender pay gap as part of how workplace discrimination kind of plays into the wage gap in the United States. I think the Me Too movement kind of brought out some of the most egregious examples of discrimination and harassment. But again, like, I really think, you know, when we have organized workplaces, we really are able to get good contracts in place that address these issues. We're able to get good code of conduct things in place, and we're able to make our workplace stronger and safer. I mean, that's our objective, right? Whether we're working in the private sector and we're working with OSHA, or we're working in the public sector and we're trying to make sure that our workers are working in good environments that are free from sexual harassment or, you know, physical intimidation, stuff like that. So, I mean, I really think our contracts are a key to making sure that we can address those issues head on.
What needs to be done on the national, state, and local levels to effectively address, eliminate this issue?
That's a good question. And I don't know that I have an answer for that, Dennis. I mean, I really think that that some of the stuff is starting to come to the surface, and I think that it's raw, and I think people are angry about it. I think that, I don't know, I mean, for me as a woman and as a woman of color, I don't feel like there's been any progress. This issue feels really personal to me, I think, because of my gender. So I can look at things and I can look at, you know, sentences that offenders get when they, you know, rape or hurt women, and see it as a slap on the wrist. I mean, I think, I don't know what kind of reforms we need to put in place. I can tell you that as a union worker, our contracts, making sure we have good, solid contracts that protect women, I think is a first step, at least from my perspective. Like, globally and nationally, I don't really have a great answer for that.
That's all right, then. Let's move on to this one. And you mentioned it earlier, and it's an important issue, critical issue for women labor leaders, and that's single working mothers' paid family leave. So could you give an update on this critical issue and how important it is for the single working mother workforce?
Sure. So this was reintroduced into the legislature again this year because it's been two or three years now and it hasn't passed. So it's Senate Bill 188. Last week it cleared its first hurdle in a 3-2 vote in the Senate Business, Labor, and Technology Committee. So it is trucking along, and I think it's got some momentum. Basically, you know, this is like a type of insurance that you could pay. This way you could have paid time off if, you know, one of your family members got sick, or if you got sick or hurt, or, you know, you have a baby, you know, those kind of things, I think, is what the family leave legislation here in Colorado is designed to protect. And I think, you know, it gives a little buffer so you don't have to choose between your family and a paycheck. I think that's part of their tagline, right? Like, you don't, you know, family over paycheck.
What are some of the social and political obstacles that have prevented passage of this important legislation? And the first one I can think of is obviously partisanship.
Right.
Republican versus Democrat.
Right. I don't know. I mean, is it something that maybe folks just aren't aware of? Like, I mean, I work at the county, so I have long-term disability, I have short-term disability. I think that people take for granted the fact that not everybody has those, and I can speak from experience. You know, growing up, both of my parents were self-employed. They went to work when they were sick. You know, my mom cut part of her cast off on her arm because she's a barber, because she couldn't take time off. I mean, her not being at work means her not earning a paycheck. So I think part of it's privilege and not understanding that this is just something that's really needed. And then I think you hit the nail on the head. It's partisanship. I mean, this thing is kind of rolling along now because there's Democratic control in both the Senate and the House, you know, and then obviously the governor's mansion. So I mean, I think those are probably the two biggest reasons why folks would disagree with that.
Let's move. We got about 10 minutes left, and I want to move into the second segment of the title of the show, and that's Women Labor Political Leaders. So, Josette, how important is it for union women workers to pursue public office?
So, I think that it's incredibly important for some of the reasons that we talked about, you know, earlier in this segment. Is it's important to have representation, and it's important for somebody to be in a position where you have a direct effect on policy to come in there and speak from experience. You can talk about what has my experience been as a worker? What have I heard when I'm talking to members? You know, those are the kind of things that I think are invaluable. to policymakers and to legislators, whether it's, you know, at the national level, the state level, or the local level. I mean, all politics is local, right? So recruiting women labor leaders to run for office, I think, is ultimately important because they can carry those stories forward and really affect policy and make change.
What kind of long-term, you know, let's think long-term, positive impact can the election of union women workers, how can it greatly assist women workers and subsequently all workers and their families?
Well, I mean, I think like we've been talking about the gender pay gap and family leave and things that we've been trying to pass for years. So having women labor leaders take some of those elected official positions and carry that message forward and carry the voice of the workers forward has long-term implications for workers and can affect, you know, policies and pensions and leave and stuff like that for years and years and years to come.
You now have been, you know, president of Colorado AFL-CIO for 18 months. And I know previous to the initial interview we had about a month after you were elected, you and Dennis Doherty, executive director, went to a conference in St. Louis, Missouri. And with that said, to finish up this question, how has the national AFL-CIO supported this effort, you know, for to get union women workers elected to public office? And I'm thinking conferences, training, and have you participated in any more since then?
I have, actually. I'm really glad that you asked this question because it's something that we're trying to get off the ground here in Colorado. The National AFL-CIO has a program that's called Path to Power, and it is a training program for our union members who would like to run for office. You know, for some of the things that we talked about, really carrying that worker message forward wherever you get elected. So we're working on bringing that program here to Colorado, getting some of our folks trained to run for those local elected official offices or state offices or whatever it is they want to do. So that's part of that. The first time I took part in that training was at the Pride at Work National Convention, and then I did it again here in Colorado. So we're working on some of that stuff. There's always trainings and conferences and all of this really cool stuff that's happening all over the country. I think we get an email once a week for a webinar. So they're always making sure that we're staying up to date and staying current. But that's part of how the National is assisting us here in Colorado with getting, you know, not only union women to run for office, but just union members in general. And then I think here in Colorado, we've always really been supportive of Emerge, which is like specifically designed for women to be elected into office. So,
Josette, you're native to Pueblo, Southern Colorado. Do you have any information, data, with the number of union women workers holding public office in that geographical region, Pueblo, Southern Colorado? And I'm thinking there might be the state legislature, Colorado State Legislature, but I'm thinking of the number of many city councils and school boards in the region.
So we don't have a ton of local information about elected officials. What we do have is the statewide numbers. For Pueblo, we just elected Bree Buenteo to House District 47, and she is a card-carrying member of the Pueblo Education Association. And then I don't know if many people know this. I don't think that she like screams it from the rooftop, but I'm going to, is Danaya Escar is actually a member of Pride at Work. And Pride at Work is the LGBT arm of the AFL-CIO. So I'm going to count her in that because I think she's fantastic and does great work. Getting women in general, I think, elected in Pueblo has been kind of challenging. All of our county elected officials are men, and I believe all of our city elected officials are men as well.
But, you know,
unless I'm forgetting someone.
Beyond elected positions, why is it important also to seek appointments on boards, commissions, so on and so forth, for union women workers?
That's where the good work happens, right, is those boards and commissions. they really, I think, get to take a deeper dive and looking at policy and looking at implications for workers, I think, than a lot of people realize. So getting appointed to those boards and commissions is hugely important. And, you know, getting a woman's perspective in local government is just insanely important. I mean, we're like 52% of the population, and to have us not represented in city and county government at all is just weird.
Gisette, we have about 2 minutes, maybe 2.5 minutes, and I want to get into a summary. So let me begin with this. Is it moving forward? What issues would you like to pursue, advocate for all workers and their families in the state of Colorado, especially Southern Colorado, in your dual positions of president, Colorado AFL-CIO, and president of AFSCME Local Union 1335, Pueblo County?
So I look at this as being kind of a wish list. And my wish list for workers in Colorado is having trauma services for child welfare workers, making organizing easier in local government across the state of Colorado, collective bargaining for state employees, looking at increased apprenticeship utilization, and then looking at programs like EPIC, which is the Equity and Possibilities in Construction, which helps get women into those apprenticeship programs. So, like, offhand, like, five things, like, those. That's my top five wish list that I think is pertinent, at least, to this conversation right now.
All right, then. Let's finish up with this one, as I always do with all guests. Do you have any final thoughts or comments for this?
I don't. I just want to thank you for... Oh.
I'm just going to just ask if you had any final thoughts or comments for this KGNU listening audience in the context of tonight's subject, Women's History Month, Women Labor and Political Leaders, Part 2. But if you're satisfied with whatever you've said at this point, I'll be okay with that as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. I mean, I really always appreciate talking to you. It's not like an interview as much as it is a conversation.
All right, then. And for those of you who've joined us late, the subject of tonight's program was Women's History Month, Women Labor and Political Leaders, Part 2. And with us was a very special guest, Josette Jaramillo, President, Colorado AFL-CIO, and President, AFSCME, Local Union 1335 in Pueblo County, Pueblo, Colorado. If you have any comments about this show or any other show on KGNU, please call 303-447-9911. And next week, Monday, November 4th, 2019, please listen to La Lucha Sigue at 6 p.m. And as a special reminder, tomorrow, please vote. Mail in your ballot. It's always important to get 100% turnout to get good results for everybody. This has been the Labor Exchange, and I am Dennis Kreese for KGNU Community Radio.
Sha-la-la-la, 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 sha-la-la-la.